Everywhere I go, people want to attribute my kids' behavior to their gender. Oh, look at how sweet your girl is. Just wait till the hormones hit in adolescence. Look at how rough and tumble your boy is. Boys are just different, aren't they? And yet, these same people who talk constantly about gender, who attribute everything to gender in front of their children who are listening, seem to think their children aren't listening, and that their own ideas about gender have no effect on their behavior or their parenting. They earnestly tell me that they parented in a gender-neutral way and that their children just naturally developed into complete gender stereotypes, uncoincidentally, the very gender stereotypes that they believe in. It is exhausting and demoralizing to witness. Hi, I'm Zonva Lines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about gender stereotypes, how these gender stereotypes affect our parenting, and how they affect our world. I'm so excited to be interviewing the inimitable Cordelia Fine. Cordelia Fine is an academic and writer. Her work analyzes scientific and popular biological explanations of behavioral sex differences and workplace gender inequalities, explores the effects of gender-related attitudes and biases on judgments and decision-making, and contributes to debates about workplace gender equality. She was recently named a living legend of research by The Australian. She is the author of Patriarchy, Inc., Testosterone Rex, Delusions of Gender, and a Mind of Its Own, and has been published in more than a dozen languages. Among other accolades, Testosterone Rex won the Royal Society Insight Investment Science Book Prize. Delusions of Gender was listed in 10 books about women that will change your life, 22 books women think men should read, top 10 books on women in the past 30 years, and the New York Public Library's Essential Reads on Feminism, 100 years after the 19th Amendment, among others. In recognition of her work on the understanding of gender stereotypes, challenging gender perceptions, and contributions to public discourse to close the gender gap, she was awarded the 2018 Edinburgh Medal by the City of Edinburgh Council to honor men and women of science who have made a significant contribution to the understanding and well-being of humanity. Cordelia Fine has degrees from Oxford University, Cambridge University, and UCL, and is now a professor in the History and Philosophy of Science program in the School of Historical and Philosophical Studies at the University of Melbourne. So I'm thrilled to have Cordelia here, but before we get started, I'm going to do a few quick administrative reminders. First, you can find Cordelia's books and all of the books I mentioned on the show, as well as a ton of reading lists and recommendations on the Liberating Motherhood Bookshop page. You'll also find that the Liberating Motherhood website has a cornucopia of information about my work, this podcast, the people I've interviewed, including details on how to appear on the podcast, how to submit a story for the podcast, how to submit an advice question, how to contact me, anything you could possibly imagine. Check it out at liberatingmotherhood.org. And finally, just a reminder that this podcast is free, but it is not free to make. My work exists solely because of the commitment and generosity of paid subscribers. People who pay to support this work get a bonus podcast every month, at least 8 extra essays each month, and access to the private Liberating Motherhood support group. Subscribe at zon.substack.com. If you'd like to help support the podcast in other ways, then liking, commenting, sharing, or leaving a positive review is more helpful than you might realize. Social media algorithms are actively punishing feminist writing, but engaging with feminist writing and scholarship you love can help counter this trend, ensuring that there's always a market and an outlet for quality feminist scholarship. Sharing my podcast with others helps me to continue to get great guests like Professor Fine. Cordelia, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm a longtime fan of your scholarship, and it's had such an impact on me and on everybody I meet, really, because I won't stop talking about it. Countering the dominant narrative about gender is so important, and you've just done it so eloquently. So thank you.
Thank you. It's an endless task. I feel like I just took the baton from well, feminists who came before me, to be honest.
It really, God, it is because I recently did a podcast where we talked about women are from Mars, men are from Venus, and it just feels like this has been going on forever. And of course, there's a reason for that. So before we kind of get into why this exists, how it exists, and how we counter it, tell me a little bit about how you got into this line of research.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked that because I think sometimes, particularly my critics, assume that, I keep Judith Butler by my bedside as a as a sort of Bible, and I set out to prove my pre-existing beliefs about gender being socially constructed. But that's really not how I kind of tumbled into this area of research. So many, many years ago, when my children were preschoolers, so much younger, they're in their early 20s now, I was working part-time as a research associate and at Monash University, which is an Australian university in Melbourne. And I was on someone else's project, which was to do with neuroethics. So this was interested in how this rise of the new neuroimaging technologies was changing our conceptions of ourselves. So this is a philosophical project, right? So we had these new brain scanners, and neuroscientists were either, looking at structural features of the brain using these technologies, or looking at patterns of blood flow and looking at brain activation patterns. And yeah, so this project was, with this new technology that seems to promise to offer us a sort of insight into our brains, into our very souls, how is that changing our sense of ourselves? At the same time, of course, because my children are very young, I was working part-time, and because I'm an academic, I was reading a lot of parenting books. Like, I sort of wanted to research my way into being a better parent. And one of the books that I read was actually recommended to be by one of the mothers in my mother's group, was called, I think, Why Gender Matters by Leonard Sachs. And that was drawing on these same new neuroimaging studies to say, look, this new technology is telling us what we always knew all along, which is that men and women's brains are fundamentally different. And this particular book was arguing that this was the reason that we needed to parent boys and girls differently, and we also needed to educate them differently. And the particular author was a real advocate for single-sex schooling. So I was kind of interested about this, because my PhD was in I did it at the Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of London. And although I didn't use neuroimaging technologies, I was looking at the effects of damage to particular parts of the brain on cognitive and social processing. And people hadn't been talking about sex differences in the brain. So I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And so I looked up the study that was being cited as evidence for, I can't quite remember now, but why we should teach maths differently to boys versus girls. And I was like, there was like basically no connection between what the study showed and the claim that was the educational implications that were being drawn from it. So I got kind of curious about this, and so I started to go, into bookshops, and I started to look at these self-help books, and I started to see that, whether it was to do with relationships or making more money in your business or parenting, these books were again drawing on this new neuroimaging technology to say, male and female brains are fundamentally different. And, whether it was you need to educate them boys differently to girls, or whether it was like you need to leverage female capital to make, unprecedented profits, it was the same kind of message. And because I was part of this neuroethics project, I was thinking, well, this is really interesting. This is a way that this new neuroimaging technology is being used to sort of tell us, oh, look, science is, this new scientific technology is sort of reinforcing what, those stupid feminists always told us were just gender stereotypes. So I was, as an academic, I was able to, as I say, look up the actual studies that these being based on. And I wrote a sort of early article about it, which I'm sure literally a handful of people have read. But it was when I saw that original book being promoted in my son's kindergarten that I thought, I feel like there needs to be an accessible deconstruction of what's actually going on here, that these scientific findings are being misrepresented, they're being actually fabricated in some cases, they're being totally overinterpreted. And my goal, I'd written A Mind of Its Own, so I knew I could write a book, was I thought I'd like to write a book explaining, what the science does and doesn't show. So I did get the contract to write what the book that became Delusions of Gender. But that book actually changed as well during the course of writing it, because originally my target was just these popularizers, that they were going over the top, they're exaggerating, they're treating gender stereotypes as if they were true of all boys and all girls, all just the usual stuff. But when I went to look at the scientific research more closely to see, well, what does the science actually say? It was then I realized that this was actually a much more complicated book, that the science itself was infused with kind of gender biases, that it was being distorted by gender stereotypes. And so I sort of had to go back to the publisher and say, this is going to take a bit longer to write, and it's going to be a more controversial book. And I felt I was at that time, I was quite sort of intellectually isolated. I was had mother of young children. I didn't have secure employment. I didn't have a kind of intellectual community around me. And there I was, sort of critiquing work coming out of labs at Cambridge, Oxford University, etc. This, as you said, this kind of mainstream view. And it was only towards the end of finishing the book that I actually met another, a fellow traveller in this terrain, Rebecca Jordan Young, whose book Brainstorm came out just about the same time. And that was a sort of real relief. You say, okay, I'm not mad. she hers was, based on decades of studying research looking at hormones and masculinity and femininity. But we both had a very skeptical take on this work. So that's a very long story about how I fell into it. And then I just, I became fascinated by the topic. So delusions of gender was, it was about this idea of prenatal hormones wiring male brains and female brains, and about neuroimaging technologies and the sort of overinterpretation and false positive biases and the way that we project our gender stereotypes onto these very ambiguous data. And it was mostly around this idea of, this very old idea of men as thinkers and women as feelers. And then I moved to work at a business school, and there was a lot of talk there about, risk-taking and competition, and this version of the business case for diversity that was really flavored with this idea of, women having skills and competencies that men lack. And of course, economists were very interested in risk-taking and competition. These are sort of really core concepts in economics. And so then I began to get interested in, ideas about circulating testosterone at sexual maturity, risk-taking, competition, status-seeking, and this whole sort of evolutionary story that our ideas about gender are framed within, and that became Testosterone Rex. And Patriarchy Inc. I think that it's definitely the final chapter. I was actually talking to someone who works in the area as well, and she said, "Oh, what's next?" And I said, "Oh, I'm done with gender." She's like, "Oh, that's amazing! You've said everything that you want to say about it." I was like, "No, I'm done with gender." Anyway, so you can frame it as a positive way or a negative way, but I feel like with Patriarchy Inc., like I am done.
Well, I have to say I'm a little worried that you might not be able to be done because so I worked very briefly with primates, enough to know like three facts and be completely useless. But one of the things that was constantly circulating when I was working with primates is the study of rhesus monkeys, where they used a sample size of, I don't know, like five or seven, and they gave these juvenile monkeys toys, human toys, and the boy monkeys, as the researchers called them, were attracted to cars, and the girl monkeys were attracted to dolls. And I remember hearing about this in the popular press, and then actually reading the study, and the study was just like ludicrous. It's like, by what evolutionary mechanism would monkeys learn to be attracted to cars? Like this is just silly. But I raise that because it just seems like there's always a new study trying to prop this up, whether it's with monkeys or apes or brain scans. It just feels so endless.
Yes, that's right. And I think, as the, I mean, this is the one of the points that I made in Delusions of Gender, and of course many have made it before me and since, is that as the tech every new technology is a kind of new way of reinscribing those old ideas. So once it was filling up the skulls with millet grain, and oh look, you can fit more millet grain into a male brain than a female brain, and of course a white brain than a black brain. So that's why white men are the at the absolute top of the intellectual ladder. Right through to now we have using machine learning to see if they can classify brains as male and female with a high degree of accuracy. And but when you go into research with sort of pre-existing assumptions, there's always this risk of confirmation bias within research. So the computational using machine learning is to classify male and female brains is a good example. So other researchers have shown, well, if you give the algorithm brains to say, these are male brains and these are female brains, now classify these ones, you're actually already telling the algorithm that there are two kinds of brains, male and female brains. But if this is work by Daphna Dwell, if you actually say, look, just here's a bunch of brains, cluster them into groups based on similarity, maybe two groups, maybe three groups, maybe four groups, maybe five groups, right? They don't pick out male and female brains. So it's a good example of the way in which the kind of question that you the assumptions that you make starting in can get built into the research itself, and then confirm what you thought all along.
Yeah. So in the early days of our parenting, my husband and I were very committed to not doing the gender socialization. And the idea that we came up with is we weren't going to go so far as to not gender our child, but we weren't going to talk about gender. We weren't going to say, oh, there's a boy, there's a girl. We weren't going to say you're a smart girl, because we felt as soon as we gave her these categories, she would start using them. So we wanted to minimize the use of categories. And I do feel that it made a big difference with her. But the thing that I noticed when I was pregnant with her that was just, I was so taken aback by, I was not prepared for, is how aggressively people were projecting gender stereotypes onto her from the time she was a literal fetus. I mean, I remember ultrasound technicians making up entire stories about her based on her being a girl. And also assumptions about how I would feel about her, how my husband would feel about her. People would talk about how he might be disappointed to not have a boy, or talk about how excited I must be to be giving birth to my future best friend, and how we'd play Barbies and makeup together. It was just stunning. And then when she was born, and I know the research supports that how they do it, but it was just so bizarre to see it unfolding. She'd be crying in the hospital, and the nurses would be like, oh, she's scared, and she's an intense girl with those strong emotions. Whereas, of course, if she was a boy, it would have been, look how tough and angry he was. It was shocking. So I wonder if you could speak a little bit to that early gender socialization, how it affects things, how it affects families, and I think generally just kind of the data that you think people need to know about this.
So I think I mean you're right. You can't create a gender-free childhood, obviously, as you know. And in fact, there's interesting research showing that even in sort of in the first m months of birth, babies are starting to develop. Oh, I'm so sorry, my cat is feeling very vocal today. So that even from quite an early age, babies are kind of noticing differences between male and female faces and sort of tr starting to create these categories. But of course, we emphasize it in so many different ways through the use of pronouns and different names and different hairstyles and different clothing. And that's even before you get to all the kind of content that you're talking about, these gender stereotypes. So the developmental research shows that children are starting to pick up that, they're little sponges, they're starting to learn those associations really from a very early age, but it's around about the age of two when the child develops that sense of their own gender identity that it gains a kind of personal meaning to them. And it's really, I was just struck when you were talking about how things were being projected onto your child, your daughter, even before she was born. It's like she doesn't have any other characteristics to create a story about. And it's true that when you're a child, you don't have a profession. When you're very young, you're not a netball player or something like that, right? So these social categories, including gender, are very prominent, and they're sort of one of the few things that you have to make sense of who a person is. So I think gender can loom very large, both in terms of how an individual is seen by other people and how they perceive themselves. So I think, there's obviously a lot of diversity in families. Some families see it as maybe even their role to still to enforce what they see as appropriate masculine and feminine behavior, or perhaps it's just, you want to make sure that your child will get on okay in the world and not be bullied, for example, which is, a really real concern. Or you're sort of somewhat unthinking about it, and you think that these things will sort of naturally unfurl regardless of whether or not you mention them or not. So I think, obviously we can't just make generalizations about all families, because families are so different in their gender-related beliefs and goals and how they parent and so on. But I think what's one of the things that really struck me when I was writing Patriarchy Inc. was, the way that thinking about the human mind as, what's unique and distinct about it and different from rhesus monkeys and chimpanzees is it the fact that it's evolved to be enculturated, and even things like the kind of emotions that we feel and when we feel them are being conditioned from an early kind of age. So we think about those, even those early caregiver interactions. What kinds of things are you drawing your child's attention to? How are you responding when they express different kinds of emotions? Just even these very sort of unthinking, reflective behaviors are already in some sort of way shaping your child's development. And they're not sort of things that we, are worrying about. I mean, how do you, if you have a, you ha I have two sons, like how would I even know whether I would respond to a daughter differently? I mean, I guess maybe if you had a boy and a girl twins, it might be a little bit more obvious. But yeah, these things start early. They can be automatic. They don't necessarily have to be conscious. And then I have to say, yeah, as once the child reaches sort of the age of two or thereabouts, and they know which side of this, incredibly important gender divide that they belong, then this process of self-socializing begins, and parents become, I would say, less, parents are never unimportant, but this is the point where, the parents can be frustrated because they don't want their daughter to, go around in that pink frilly dress that means that they can't climb on the monkey bars or whatever it might be. But the child knows, the daughter knows, like this is what girls wear, and they've become very aware of those norms. I remember when my youngest was in kindergarten, and they had a kind of dress up day, and all of the girls except one dressed up as a princess. I think the other girl, she dressed as a pirate or something like that, and then the next dress up day, she was dressed up as a princess too, and she saw she saw what the norm was, and she quite understandably wanted to conform. And that's, one of the points I want to make in Patriarchy Inc. is, that's how we cooperate. That's how we're able to achieve this extraordinary cooperation, which is how we solve the problems of survival and reproduction, by internalizing, detecting, and enforcing norms, by developing these social identities, by sort of developing the sense of what it means to be someone like me and what the responsibilities and roles and expectations are. And gender is, just a core one that's ubiquitous and universal. But just with any other social identity, we have to be enculturated into it.
Well, and I think also it becomes this form of like bonding and small talk. I especially see it. So I have two fairly young children who are both kind of newly in school. And so we're at the point where we're trying to make friends with other parents and that sort of thing. And one of the small talk subjects is like, oh, aren't girls different? Or, well, you don't know what it's like for me because I have boys and you have girls. And it's very difficult to, climb up on the soapbox I carry in my purse and be like, well, actually, you're wrong because I don't want to be the most hated mother in the school. And so you end up just kind of like smiling and nodding, and it becomes this like pro-social way for people to bond, even though its long-term effects are really not very pro-social.
Well, you can imagine I identify with that and sympathize because I was writing Delusions of Gender when my children were little. And so yes, I would have very much the same kinds of conversations and at the playground, and you have this dilemma, like, are you the jerk who disrupts that smooth social conversation?
So how did
Or
you, what did you do? Which path did you choose? Did you choose the path of having friends or not having friends?
Well, I like to think that I managed both, but I don't, maybe some would disagree. But you said actually, you could say actually, and I'd say interestingly, and then I
Oh,
would
that's
come up with
nicer.
some, study about that showing that the average difference was there was a huge amount of overlap, or whatever it was, or even, I remember once having a conversation with another parent, and she also had two sons, and I was just mentioning that I was reading Pippi Longstocking to one of my children, and they were really, really enjoying it, and she just says, oh, it sort of never occurred to me that my boys might enjoy that. And it was just because it was about a female character, Pippi
Yeah.
Longstocking. And she so I don't know, I mean, I think I just said, well, it's a great book. I'm like, my children are really, really enjoying it. And I don't know if she decided that, maybe her boys could hear stories about girls too. But you probably have to ask one of the mums to see how well I managed to navigate that particular
It's
territory.
tricky. I mean, I try to be a
Actually,
counterexample. Like sometimes I'll say, oh, like I haven't noticed that with mine or something like that. But people can be really, really persistent with it. I especially see it with parents of boys, actually, I guess because they're, they see their experiences different from mine. So they're trying to share kind of what their experience is. And, boys are so aggressive. And I'm like, well, mine are going home from school every day and beating on each other too. Like they're pretty aggressive sometimes.
Yes, it's difficult to it is difficult to navigate these conversations. I actually remember spending in a school event. I think I felt like hours. It probably was only 20 minutes, but having an argument about whether there could ever be a sort of women's league of this hugely popular game here. It's a bit like rugby. It's called Australian Football League, or Aussie Rules, and this person was arguing with me for what seemed like hours that, women wouldn't want to play over, it was too rough, people wouldn't want to watch it, blah, blah, blah. Well, what do you know? Several years later, actually, the league has, after much, much fighting, has finally came into fruition. And he actually kind of, when I bumped into him, he remembered the conversation, and he said, you're right. And I thought that was very
Oh,
gracious.
that must
Very
have felt
gracious.
really good. There's nothing like being told you're right after you've argued with someone. I love that for him and for you. So I think a lot of folks think they have this kind of fallacious reasoning that if something is biological, like if we can see it in the brain or we can see it in the hormones or we can see it in the body, then it's hardwired, it's natural, it was always there. But one of the things that I really appreciate about your work is you talk about how culture and environment influence biology, and how even if there is this demonstrable difference between the brains, it doesn't mean that they were born or conceived that way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I think there is this sense of if it's biological, it's innate and it's fixed. And, even people who take a quite different line to me on sex differences, would say, well, that's simply not the case. So one thing that really struck me when I was doing a lot of research into these studies of differences between males and females in, functional imaging studies, for example, was this kind of tacit assumption that if you see a difference in brain activation between your women and your men in your study, then somehow that must be it must be innate. And that's certainly an assumption that was made quite explicitly by the popularizers. So they would certainly assume that if you saw in the brain, it was innate. But of course, you're not unwrapping your participants from their boxes unused and putting them in the scanner. They've had a, 20, 30, 40 years of living in a gendered world. And particularly when we're thinking about brain activation studies, where else would we see the effects of socialization but in the brain or the way that we sort of process information? But having said that, I have to say that I think one of the big issues with all of those kinds of studies is that there were just a lot of spurious results. So, this is a general issue. There's been a replication crisis in psychology, other behavioral sciences, and the issue is that you run a study, you need to find something interesting. They're expensive. You need to publish. You need a high impact in a publication. One really easy thing to do is to divide your group by gender, compare them. If you find a difference, you make that the focus of your study. And as I think I talk about it in Delusions of Gender, and I've done academic work since, all too often those differences are just they're just one-off. They're spurious false results from this very noisy data. So, even if you have to sort of be skeptical about some of these findings in the first place, and then even then, that doesn't mean that those differences are innate. And also, we don't know what they mean. And one of the things that I did analysis of 2 years of functional neuroimaging data, and what I found was that speaking to your point about the implicit assumption that things are innate, all of these studies were just sort of single snapshots. So they look for a sex difference, and then that's it. That's the end of the investigation. They're not interested in seeing, well, do we see the same difference in a different population? What happens if we, change the context? Do we still see the same difference? Where does it come from? If we change the gender norms that are prevailing, do we still see the, instead of seeing it as the starting point of the investigation to see, where does this difference come from, when, why, and how do we see it? Instead, that's just the end. And, if that's how you're doing your research, you're guaranteed never to produce data that will challenge the idea that these sex differences in the brain are immutable, universal, fixed, etc. So even though the neuroscientists themselves aren't saying, oh, it must be innate, as the popularizers do, they're also not generating any data that could challenge that assumption. And the other thing I found in that analysis was that the way that the scientists would draw on gender stereotypes to kind of putty fill in that gap between our understanding of this and highly complex organ, the brain, and what it actually means. Like, what does it mean for a part of the frontal lobes to be activated a bit more in men than in women? And there's a beautiful example of the sort of way that gender stereotypes are functioning that comes from the philosopher Robin Bloom, who analyzed neuroimaging studies of gender differences in emotion processing. Of course, there's this idea, like you refer to these nurses talking about how emotional your daughter is. Like, this is a very, very strong gender stereotype. And she was interested in the role that it would play in these functional neuroimaging studies. And so she was looking at studies that were interested in the role of a region of the frontal lobe, which is, involved in cognitive control, while participants were looking at emotion arousing images. And basically what she found was that some studies found that that part of the frontal lobe was more activated in men. Some found that it was more activated in women. Some found no differences, but somehow all of the scientific groups, research teams managed to include that their findings demonstrated that women were more emotional than men. Right? So regardless of what they found, that was the conclusion. And you can make a story about all of it, right? If men's are more activated, it's like, oh, they're controlling their emotions. If it's more activated in the women, it's like, oh, women are having such strong emotions that they need more frontal lobe to deal with it, right? You can make up a plausible story, and that story is infused with gender stereotypes so that we still get the right conclusion. Sorry, I know we've strayed a little bit from the original question, which was about the way that biology itself is shaped by culture.
No, this is great.
So,
This is very interesting, is how we frame things. So I'll tell you, because I spoke with the writer Stephanie O'Connell earlier this week, and she has a book about women and ambition, and kind of like the lies we tell about women at work, and women don't negotiate and women don't seek power, and that's why there's a wage gap and all of this kind of thing. And one of the things that she talks about is how we never say that we're not promoting a woman because she's a woman. It's always, well, she's too old. So then you present a younger woman and she's too young. It's she's too pretty or too ugly. She's too ambitious or not ambitious enough. And it slowly builds this scaffold where there's just like no way for women to succeed. And I think there's like a similar dynamic with this gender difference research of like, no matter what the conclusion is, the story is women are emotional and men are leaders and all of this kind of nonsense.
Yeah, and look, some of my colleagues and I, we tried to draw attention to this issue because we were aware that people s are sometimes maybe not starting out interested in sex differences, but maybe they look for one because they haven't found anything that's so interesting, or they find one and they need to make sense of it. And we just we've tried to write studies that are just not saying don't study sex differences. It's good to look at sex effects. We're not against that, of course. Well, not of course, but we're certainly not against investigating these kinds of differences or effects. But to do it well and to be aware of the ways in which gender stereotypes can, shape the questions that we ask, the methods that we use, the interpretations that we make, and the conclusions that are drawn. And it's been good to see some traction. We're writing in mainstream scientific journals, but it's really an uphill battle. And I think even in the time that I've been working in this area, the narrative has kind of changed. So it's changed from, oh, let's find out why women are more emotional, to let's find out why women are more susceptible to mental health conditions. And I find that really interesting, and I don't quite know how to think about that. But I think, regardless of what the values are that are driving the research, and of course we all want to have a better understanding of causes of anxiety and depression and how we might better treat them, we still need to be doing rigorous good quality research. And not assuming that it's when we compare women and men, all we're seeing are the effects of sex-related genes and hormones. Of course, we're not.
All right, so speaking of women being too emotional, I have something I want to ask you about that I've not really spoken to a researcher who I felt like can answer this for me, and it's not something you've specifically written about. So if you have no idea, you can just tell me that, but I'll paint the picture for you. So, you've written a lot about how we blame hormones for things, and we especially often will use hormones to dismiss women. She's PMSing and that's why she's upset. And my own experience as a woman has been that, at every stage of my development, we do this thing with women where we dismiss their behavior because of their hormones. So if you're pregnant and like you're struggling with the reality of being a pregnant person, of pregnancy discrimination, of, the financial challenges of pregnancy, of the danger of pregnancy in the United States, like that's just your pregnancy hormones. After you've had the baby, if you're struggling to get support, if breastfeeding is hard, if you're sleep deprived, all of that's just postpartum depression. We always locate the problem in the individual woman and her crazy woman hormones. So now I'm seeing this new trend. I'm 42 now. And the new trend I see is suddenly we're blaming everything on perimenopause. And the story is women are hitting perimenopause and they're going crazy and they're leaving their husbands because of their crazy perimenopause disease. And my perspective is that what's really happening is that there's a huge awakening among a lot of women about the dynamics of marriage and child rearing and all of that. And that's why women are leaving their husbands or becoming feminist and all of that. But I'm starting to see this weaponization of perimenopause. And the thing that really concerns me is that I'm often seeing it in feminist circles where, yes, we don't research women's health enough and we don't know enough about perimenopause and all that. But I'm just seeing this dynamic where even feminist women are saying, well, maybe I'm overreacting because I'm perimenopausal. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Oh yeah, this is such a fascinating issue. And actually, I hadn't heard this sort of perimenopause leaving your husband thing. But where what I hear is, and I'm older than you, menopause and women are leaving the workplace. So they're just about to, they're in the top positions, and then they leave because of menopausal issues. But yes, the word perimenopause does seem to be absolutely everywhere. I am fascinated by this. I mean, my university has a, I don't remember its exact name, but it's sort of almost like a hormone support group, and in a sense, it sort of stigmatizes females at like any or it's like, may is it your menstrual cycle, if it is pregnancy, or it's perimenopause or menopause. But it's basically sort of saying, at any stage of your life, you're going to need help, support with about over and about your hormones. And I know it's well intentioned, and it might well be valuable, but there's also this worry that you're basically saying, this is long-standing concern about the way that doubt is cast on women's confidence and capabilities because of their hormones. And I'm completely with you on this tension, because you're right, like there hasn't been enough research into genuine difficulties that women might face, whether it's during pregnancy, whether it's in the lead up to menopause, during menopause, post-menopause, etc. We do need to know more. It sort of seems extraordinary how little we actually do seem to know, and how much uncertainty there is around a lot of these medical issues. But at the same time, I've looked at some of the research that's, trying to draw links between menopausal status and mental health issues, for example, and it's just not good quality. And there is this worry that it's just a sort of it's a re-stigmatizing of women, and it's a way of, providing an explanation for, why it is that, women are leaving the workplace when they're about to reach those senior roles, or whatever it might be. And I think, yeah, it's the same issue that I have. I think it needs, there was this sort of second wave interrogation of these concepts like PMS, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, for example. That was sort of work that was done in the maybe the 1980s and the 1990s. And it feels like with this rise of what is something to be celebrated, which is this insistence on taking women's health issues seriously, to not treat female bodies like sort of small versions of male bodies, etc. You know, that nonetheless, like, we still need that critical attention on how that research is being done, how it's being interpreted. We need like a new wave of that kind of gender scholarship. And you know, to some extent it is being done. So for example, Sarah Richardson at Harvard University, she has something called the Gender Science Lab, which does incredible work. And some of the work that it does is, you know, interrogating these assumptions about needing sort of sex-specific medicine, for example, and just drawing attention to when you have differences in outcomes between men and women, let's not just jump to the conclusion that it's because of, you know, sex-related genes or hormones. Let's think about other things. Let's think about gender norms that prevent men from seeking attention for their health issues. Let's think about the kinds of economic circumstances that women and men are in. Let's think about gender norms that make certain kinds of side effects more problematic for women than for men, or whatever it might be, right? And once we start to take these into account and actually look more closely at the outcome data, we find a much more complicated story. So there is some of this work going on, but I really would love to see. I'd love to see a really kind of intelligent, critical probing of exactly that tension that you're talking about, because it does, yeah, we need to recognize that certain things happen in bodies, and that's not always trouble-free. But we also need to recognize that we have not eliminated gender biases from scientific research, and that these ideas can offer very powerful explanations that attribute causes internally rather than externally in ways that are actually quite misleading.
I did find one study a couple of months ago. I can't remember the author. I'll have to go dig it up. And it was a small sort of qualitative study, but she found that women in domestically violent relationships who were going through perimenopause or who believed they were going through perimenopause would often blame their emotional reactions to the violence on perimenopause. And then when they saw it, medical care, their care providers would like adopt that narrative of this is perimenopause causing you to be depressed or anxious rather than the abuse you're experiencing. And that's so alarming to me.
Yeah, I mean, there was work by Jane Usher that was sort of making these similar kinds of points. Like, this was to do with PMS, but you know, interviewing women and you know, just a sort of simplified version of what she was finding. But you know, basically, women would be quite reasonably angry at things that their partners or children were doing, the way they were being treated, but it would be attributed to their PMS. Actually, a teacher course called Bad Science, and I show an advert for a drug to treat premenstrual dysphoric disorder, and it just has a woman. You know, she's trying to get out of the house in the morning, and she's looking for her keys, and she's like, "Where are my keys? Did you take my keys?" And she's just a bit irritated because she's obviously late, and you know, and then it's like, "Do you need this drug?"
Oh my God.
And I just laugh because, like, that is me, like, every morning. Like, where are my keys? Who took my
It's
keys? Oh,
all
here
of
they are.
us. The key woman is all of us. I'm reminded, this is a much less funny story of a breastfeeding group I'm in. And a woman posted recently, and she's, about my age, but also has a new baby that she's breastfeeding. And she shared about how abusive her husband is, and he yells at her, and he doesn't get up with the baby, and he's sexually coercive, and he's shaking her, and she can't trust him with the baby, and just all this terrible stuff. And so she's struggling. She's anxious. She's sad. She's depressed. She's all the things that you would expect her to be. And so she tells this story, and then she says, "And I just can't figure out what's going on with my hormones. I don't know if it's breastfeeding hormones or postpartum hormones, or if I'm going through perimenopause and, my doctor tested my hormones, which it's like, well, which hormones? And they're all fine. And I don't know how to be taken seriously. And most of the comments were women suggesting further hormonal explanations. Well, you should get your TSH tested, and have you had your prolactin tested? And I just thought, well, have you tested the idea of getting rid of the husband? Because that to me seems like the best intervention.
Wow. Yeah, that's extraordinary. But of course, she did. That would be attributed to
To her hormones.
perimenopause.
Yeah,
But
her
oh
menopause
gosh, yeah.
rage. Just us crazy women and our crazy hormones. Cordelia, I'm so grateful to you for coming on the podcast. I'm going to put all of Cordelia's books on the bookshop and in the show notes. I highly, highly recommend her work. It's so helpful to comb through these studies when you don't have a strong scientific background. And frankly, even if you do, because there's so much data, it's impossible for a single person, I guess, who's not Cordelia, to synthesize it. Thank you so much, Cordelia.
Oh, pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
It's been wonderful having you here. And listeners, I will be back next week. So thank you for listening.